I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
I now declare that all the fun we're having here is deemed retroactive. That is, it'll negate all the bad times you ever had before, and henceforth, further make all the bad times that might be coming now better.
Yikes, that's a tall order for any radio program. But for us at Playback, making fun retroactive is our middle name, because we're the only podcast with stories from the NPR archives from exactly 25 years ago. This month, we land in January 1984 to experience the rich, full-bodied flavor of the mid-80s. Reagan does a star turn as he announces his bid for re-election. MLK Day rolls around with new significance. And radio personality Wolfman Jack makes a comeback.
Hello, who's this on the Wolfman telephone?
Hi, this is Frankie Valli, and the guy you're listening to is one of my best friends, Wolfman Jack.
You got the Wolfman, Jack!
And in addition to Wolfman Jack and his mullet, we discover what became known as a fashion don't.
Today, the jogging shoe has eclipsed the Walkman as the commuting accessory of the 80s.
It's not sexy at all.
I'm saddened for the men that have to watch it.
All that mid-80s malaise caused by women commuting in jogging shoes. But poet Andre Cădrescu didn't seem to mind. He had bigger fish to fry.
When I first came to America, my friends were quick to induct me into the cult of McDonald's. Before I could speak a complete sentence, I'd already eaten four Big Macs and was well on my way to citizenship.
Cădrescu explores the charms of our fast food nation. And in this episode of Playback, we discover the novelty of computers that talk.
I am very pleased to introduce our next guest for you today. Beautiful Betty will sing All of Me.
All of me. Why not?
Yes, our distinguished guest, Betty, will sing off-key and talk to you in her soothing, computerized voice with this report on the beginnings of synthesized speech, which leads me to this next important, unpaid political announcement from President Reagan and his running mate.
Vice President Bush and I would like to have your continued support and cooperation in completing what we began 3 years ago. I am therefore announcing that I am a candidate and will seek re-election to the office I presently hold.
Before making the announcement, the president took a few moments to describe the economic accomplishments of his first 3 years, especially the drop in inflation. As in several recent speeches, he contrasted today's economy with that in 1981.
We were on the brink of economic collapse from years of government overindulgence and abusive overtaxation. Thus, I had to report that we were, quote, in the worst economic mess since the Great Depression.
Of course, things got worse before they got better, and deficits are still higher than they've ever been, 2 points Democratic candidates will continue to emphasize. From the Republican point of view, the president could hardly afford not to run. He begins the last year of his term with the highest approval rating at that point of any president since Eisenhower. In addition, the president delayed the decision so long that had he decided not to run, other Republican candidates would have been hard-pressed to organize for the campaign just ahead. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Reagan's delay in announcing his plans for a second term had this effect on NPR commentator Daniel Shore.
In the end, the contrived suspense resembled a striptease. Anyone with an elementary knowledge of anatomy knew what would be revealed, excited only by the artful gyrations of the uncovering. Chief of Staff James Baker, one of the best deadpans in the business, said it was the president's secret until the last minute, presumably unaware that the president had told Newsweek all about it in an interview last Friday. This is the fruition of the theater of politics as practiced by the old master, guiding not only the style and timing of public appearance, but many of the policy decisions. Thus, Reagan turns the deficit tables on Congress by appealing for help in a down payment, a merchandising term that omits only the promise of easy installments to follow. Thus, according to the Washington Post, Reagan turns down a real chance for legislative authority to veto individual appropriations, preferring the theatrics of the quest for a constitutional amendment. His America is Back Standing Tall theme is an exercise in voter flattery refined by a critique of the Carter-Malaise gong show. Political theater can do wonders to ensure re-election, but not everything. The president is campaigning on the themes of peace and prosperity, and there will be some external realities that will affect Americans' perceptions of whether they're enjoying peace and prosperity come next November. Any economic downturn, any significant rise in interest rates in the next 9 months would mar the feeling of well-being among those who now enjoy it, let alone those who don't. The peace theme is a chancier matter. The Soviets, with no interest in making Reagan look good, have the capacity to raise the international temperature. They're believed to be encouraging Syrian intransigence in Lebanon, which keeps American Marines pinned down. They chose the day of the Reagan announcement to publicize charges of U.S. treaty violations. There will undoubtedly be more orchestration of tension to belie the Reagan peacemaker image.
Commentator Daniel Shore. 25 years later, like meaning right now, Mr. Daniel Shore is, of course, still on the air, and you can create a podcast of all his pieces. Just go to npr.org/podcast. In addition to political revelations, 1984 brought some professional New Year's resolutions from All Things Considered hosts Susan Stamberg and Noah Adams.
In 1984, we resolve never to allow the words George Orwell to again cross our lips.
In 1984, we resolved never to do stories on Cabbage Patch Dolls or Pia Zadora.
We never did stories on Pia Zadora,
I think. Know, but you never know when her name might pop up.
Or Joan Collins.
Definitely.
But I would like to talk with Judy Collins.
Uh-huh.
Or Tom Selleck.
Well, except that he has given us words to live by. I think it was Tom Selleck, you will remember, who said, "In the scheme of things, I'm not as important as Dr. Jonas Salk."
In 1984, we resolved to avoid stories about pasta and whether jogging is bad for your knees and men getting in touch with their feelings and new reports on the quality of education in the United States.
In 1984, we shall not discuss the amount of pine tar allowed on a baseball bat.
Coping over 40 and National Public Radio's financial difficulties.
Especially NPR's financial problems.
Especially coping over 40. However, there have been a number of stories we've always meant to do on All Things Considered, and this year we resolved to do them.
To wit. In 1984, we will present interviews with all of Brooke Shields' professors at Princeton.
A complete annotated list of all the wives of Norman Mailer.
And in 1984, we resolved to do a story about people who have spontaneously combusted.
Susan, wait a minute.
What's wrong? That's a very legitimate story.
We actually have this story right now coming up.
No kidding.
A story about people who have spontaneously combusted.
Yeah.
From Larry Massett.
This is a time of year when people worry a little bit about catching on fire, mostly about the Christmas tree catching on fire. But Joan Metallic, a writer teaching at the University of Maryland, collects stories about people who catch on fire, people who spontaneously combust.
Miss Phyllis Newcomb. Miss Newcomb, 22-year-old British girl, combusts before a room full of people while waltzing in a dance hall. August 7th, 1938. I'm sure Miss Newcomb was a virgin and destined to be a spinster, fulfilling the destiny of that label imposed by society. And somehow her cells conspired to give her a kind of racy and graceful way out of all of that. I think probably the one thing that most of these accounts do have in common is the fact of suddenness and lack of control. I don't think it's something that you feel coming on. You know, you say, I'm feeling a bit under the weather. Actually, I'm feeling like I might in a few hours combust. I think it comes on totally unawares, and that's part of the beauty of it.
Larry Massett was the reporter on our story about people who have spontaneously combusted.
What that story needed was a clip or two of actual spontaneous combustionings. Ray Kroc, the man who built the McDonald's empire, died in the middle of January 84. And for purposes of full disclosure, his wife Joan ended up leaving a part of that burger empire to NPR when she passed away in 2003. Ray Kroc's legacy had a personal meaning to commentator Andre Codrescu.
His was the only business to consciously pursue infinity, to actively haunt eternity. Already, by the time there were 1 billion sold, it was clear that only the national debt could hold a candle to that awesome figure. 5 billion, 6 billion, 7 billion. Each year was like another proud climb up the rungs of infinity. If anybody in this world's going to heaven, Ray Kroc will. When I first came to America, my friends were quick to induct me into the cult of McDonald's. Before I could speak a complete sentence, I had already eaten 4 Big Macs and was well on my way to citizenship. When I could understand, my friend Jeffrey Miller, a poet, told me that the Trinity of America was burgers, bourbon, and Marlboros, and that if I wanted to thrive, I should pay my respects. Traveling across the continent, I soon learned another secret, namely that there was no point in leaving home, because home was everywhere, identical in every way, especially in food. Gone were all those obnoxious regional differences, those embarrassing dialects, the funny food our parents used to make. What the railroad, the TV, the radio, and the telephone failed to do, McDonald's accomplished. Had Ray Kroc been a zealot leader speaking a foreign language and worshipping a savage god, we would have surely risen in arms against him for trying to obliterate our differences. But he was not. He was that brilliant and quintessential figure, the lone man with one idea. Sure, I had vegetarian friends who grumbled on behalf of all the poor cows. They said that when you died, you went to a place where you were surrounded by all the animals you ever ate, with the parts you ate missing. A chicken with just a wing gone, a cow with just a burger taken out of it. But that's nonsense. Ray Kroc would see wounded cows everywhere he looked, if that were true. McDonald's not only unified us, but it civilized us as well. Who can now accuse us of being heartless when the heart itself, as Jeffrey Miller wrote, the heart is a quarter pounder. These boys have got this
down. The heart is a quarter pounder. How true. This is a song about Ray Kroc by the group Dire Straits. Don't wait long. Shake fries. How do you go? How about that friendly name? Heck, every little thing ought to stay the same. Oh, my name's not Kroc. That's Kroc with a K. Like crocodile, but not spelt that way. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. It's Doggy Dog, ready, ready. Doggy Dog, ready, ready. When Martin Luther King's birthday rolled around in January of 84, the civil rights landscape had shifted. 2 months earlier, President Reagan had signed the Martin Luther King Holiday Bill into law. For commentator Vertimae Grosvenor, change was slow in coming.
Growing up in the 40s in a small southern town, there were black and white signs everywhere. Jim Crow, a.k.a. segregation, was a matter of fact, etiquette, and law. Restroom signs read, white men, white ladies, and colored. Buses where we were compelled to sit in the back had signs that said, this section for white people, this section for the colored race. There was one water fountain for white only. In the stores, white people were waited on first, and the clerks called us boy, gal, aunt, or uncle, never Mr. or Mrs., and they never put the change in our hand. And before we left home, we drew our feet on a piece of brown paper and fit the paper to the desired shoe. Doctor's offices, bus and train depots had separate entrances. I loved the train. Traveling north and south, I always wanted to eat in the dining car. It was a fantasy of mine. To sit at those white linen tables, to be waited on by those handsome brown-skinned men. But because of Jim Crow and our economic situation, we carried a fried chicken shoebox lunch. In the 60s, when my fantasy finally came true, The food just somehow didn't taste as good as I thought it would. Jim Crow, I suppose, has left its scars. Sometimes, if somebody calls me gal or a clerk doesn't give me change in my hand, my back bristles. It's hard to believe that Jim Crow was alive and well less than 20 years ago. In 1966, when my daughter on a visit down south was sick, she had to use the colored entrance to the doctor's office. Young people ask how we did it. I don't know. But I know it's a marvel that so many who lived with the demon Jim Crow managed to endure and triumph, bright-eyed and dignified.
Commentator Verda Mae Grosvenor. While some recalled the slow march of civil rights, others were more concerned with the actual footwear, meaning shoes. It seems improbable, but I present for your listening pleasure an unlikely story, perhaps the first in playback history, about women wearing jogging shoes to work.
Today, the jogging shoe has eclipsed the Walkman as the commuting accessory of the 80s.
They're more comfortable. Saves you good shoes. The nylon with leather trim.
They walk in with the jogging shoes, and then they change to more dressy shoes.
Waiting on a train and your feet hurt.
Well, when you're spending $80 to $120 on a pair of shoes, $80 for a pair of shoes, you're going to be out of your mind.
And you have to walk in pitiful, pitiful roads.
I think it's fine if their feet feel good.
$35 on a pair of Nikes.
Concrete ruins your shoes.
It's a little bit more wise.
It's definitely becoming a trend, and it's one that we're really happy to see.
Dr. Paul Taylor, a Washington, D.C. podiatrist, is a member of the boards of the American Running and Fitness Association, the American Academy of Podiatric Sports Medicine, and is team podiatrist of the Washington Bullets basketball team. Taylor says 60% of his patients are women with foot problems related to the shoes they wear.
The shoe that women will wear most of the time, particularly those that are working in offices, is the pump, which is a shoe that has a higher heel, a very narrow and a very crowded toe box, and walking for any distances in that pump type of shoe is bound to cause somebody problems.
Why not avoid these maladies, says Taylor, and walk to the office in jogging shoes? Surely not because you think it looks stupid.
I think it's perfectly reasonable.
Editor of Cosmopolitan magazine and noted footwear authority, Helen Gurley Brown.
Women have done outrageous things to their bodies in order to be more beautiful or acceptable, in quotes. We wore tight Mary Widow corsets all through the 50s that really took your breath away. We've worn bras when we didn't need to, not to mention girdles. We were encased in this rubber that, again, left you practically breathless. Okay, for years, forever, we've worn spike heel shoes, and I'm not willing to throw those away because they're sexy, they're adorable, and they make your legs look longer, and it's just a lovely, sexy, spicy image. But walking around on them is sheer disaster. So how perfectly sensible that finally we've decided to do our walking in flat heel shoes, and when we get where we're going, we can change into the other kind. What could be more reasonable?
Brown says she hasn't found a man yet who doesn't endorse the idea, which is probably just as well.
If they said anything derogatory, I would hit the first man who did that, because men wear flat heel shoes everywhere. If one single one of them said, oh, I hate to see a woman running around in her Keds or her Adidas, I would just say, you silly idiot. But I don't think men are complaining. I think men are just too wonderful and too sensible to do anything silly like that.
It's not sexy at all.
I'm saddened for the men that have to watch it.
I would prefer to see a nice, sleek shoe.
I don't find them very attractive.
Something in lizard, preferably.
I like women in high heels. Sort of sport up the calves a little bit. I find that a little bit more attractive.
But don't get the impression that only men find the jogging shoe look inappropriate. Fran Lebowitz, a woman, a writer, and an expert on just about everything, finds it particularly offensive.
Jogging shoes, first of all, look terrible no matter what. They look terrible on their own, just sitting on the floor.
and they look particularly horrifying with a skirt.
People have made comments like, oh, you wear those.
Well, I would like to arrest them, and I think they should go to fashion prison.
It looks tacky.
They would be compelled to be with a number of other people wearing the same thing, and they'd have to see what it really looks like.
I really don't like doing it.
Don't these people have mirrors?
Mainly because I don't like the way it looks with my attire.
I think it has something to do with liberalism.
I just don't think it looks very feminine.
I don't think you're going to find many Republicans wearing these. These are certainly people who drive Volvos, unquestionably. This is a Volvo look.
Writer Fran Lebowitz. In Washington, this is Clem Taylor reporting.
It's nice to know people in the 80s weren't shy about throwing around cliches. Because, well, they had other issues to deal with. Like the advent of machines that talk. Well, machines that try to talk and sing. Here's Ira Flatow and his talking computer friend.
I am very pleased to introduce our next guest for you today. Beautiful Betty will sing All of Me.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you
This virtuoso performance is not the product of a rising young star. Neither is the bad imitation of Lawrence Welk.
Fantastic. Just fantastic. Thank you, Betty. No, that's one lady we're bound to hear more of real soon.
Both the singer and the announcer are produced by a computer, a speech synthesizer called DeckTalk, marketed by Digital Research Corporation. DeckTalk is one of the latest devices in a growing trend. You're going to hear a lot of strange-sounding voices talking to you, mostly over the telephone, as talking computers gradually take the place of people. The idea is very simple. There's all this information out there stored in computers, information like the balance in your bank account, the price of stock, even your phone number. All these things are stored in computers to which you have no access unless you have a computer terminal yourself or you call up someone who does, like your bank teller. Now, the idea of DeckTalk and other products like it, says Digital's Ted McKee, is to allow you to get at the information by just using your touch-tone telephone.
You don't need a personal computer, no special communications gear, almost anything, and you can get at that information that's on the computer.
Now, the possibilities are endless. For example, shopping by catalog. You could call the catalog's computer, key in the item you wanted to order.
And the system could speak back with some very specific information saying, I'm sorry, that part is out of stock, and it'll be a week before we can mail it out to you. Special charges for getting it to you faster.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, lovers at first sight.
Thomas and his colleagues are involved in developing computers that talk just like people.
Strangers in the night.
You've probably already heard the simplest forms of computerized speech. These are the talking vending machines in the cars that tell you to turn off your headlights. Now, if you wonder why these voices sound very lifelike, it's because they're just recordings of real human voices imprinted in computer chips. But while the speech sounds real, this method has one major drawback. The vocabulary is very limited.
How many different phrases can your car speak?
That's because the device must be very small and cheap. Now, on the other hand, true voice synthesizers, like this one, the DeckTalk, actually make up the words from scratch, constructing the words from the basic building blocks of sound called phonemes.
A phoneme is a symbol which represents one of the unique sounds of spoken English. About 40 phonemes are required to represent the pronunciation of all English words.
Of course, once you've got passable human speech, there are almost limitless things you can do with it, from singing songs to reading out loud to your children. In the meantime, though, keep alert for those strange new voices over the phone. Be ready to answer back with your touch-tone keys. And if you get worried that machines are taking over everything, well, listen closely, and I think you'll see there are some things machines cannot do better than people.
Spread in the news. I'm leaving today.
This is Ira Flatow in New York.
Be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes
are longing to stray.
Just a little day brightener to start the new year off right. Which brings me to our final story. A very hairy radio personality.
Midnight to 5 in the morning, baby.
Ow!
Those are the Wolfman's hours, and beginning next Saturday night, he'll be back on the radio in Southern California, six nights a week, howling till dawn on AM station KRLA. Wolfman Jack has an act, and he sticks with it. He screams, he hollers, he beats on telephone books and blows whistles, chain smokes Sherman cigarettes, and always sings along with the record he's playing. It's a formula that's worked for 25 years, one that also includes his trademark listener phone calls.
Oh, I just love talking to you folks on the telephone. Hello.
Hello, Wolfman.
Yeah, who's this?
Rita Shaw.
Hey, Rita, I love you.
No.
I love you,
not
Rita.
So quickly.
What are you calling me for?
I want to make a request.
I told you to contact me later after the program we get together, you understand?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to call me while I'm on the air. You're supposed to call me after the program.
Aww.
Oh, wow. I sure hope Wolfwoman ain't listening to that one.
Wolfman Jack grew up in Brooklyn, and he likes to keep his background, along with his real name, a secret. He does reveal, however, that when he was a teenager, he bought two old turntables and began playing DJ in his cellar. He knew he had to have a great name if he was ever going to land a real radio job.
I was Goatman Irving. This goat around there ain't gonna work. and then I was Daddy Jules. No, that ain't gonna work. And then I thought about all the great forefathers before the Wolfman, the big boppers like Moondog and the Hound and all those people. I said, well, you gotta be a party animal, you know? So you gotta have a little animal in you to party. So Wolfman, and at that time the slang was, what's happening, Jack? You know? So I took on Wolfman Jack and... I even started to look like him after a while. And that's the way the whole character thing came to pass. Oh, my, my! Got green onions hanging all over the studio, precious thing. Gonna keep the vampires away, you understand? And this one, baby, is for only you.
Only you.
One of the millions of teenagers who grew up listening to Wolfman was a filmmaker named George Lucas. He later featured the DJ as a character in the movie American Graffiti. Wolfman hosted a television show, Midnight Special, for 8 years, and he syndicated a radio program to over 1,000 stations throughout the world.
You know, radio is an instrument to perform on, just like any media, you know, and I love doing radio because, to me, it's a release. My release is coming in and doing, playing records and having a good time. Just blowing away, you know.
Now we so happy right. And I love it.
In Los Angeles, for National Public Radio, I'm Steve Proffitt.
Yeah, before we leave, just like say, hi, Mom. Doing real good. Enjoyed having you with me Christmas time, and I know you're listening. I love you.
And I would just like to say a big boy howdy to my mother-in-law in Columbus, who probably will never hear this podcast. And a ginormous big old thanks to NPR's Michael Katziff and Mr. Robert Speer. And to all you folks ringing in 1984 and 2009 with me this month. Next month, the Marines pull out of Beirut, and Torvald and Dean show off their blades of glory at the 84 Winter Olympics. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.